From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Well, welcome to the latest episode of our trawl through the Formula One World Championship to pick out the best seasons. We're having a special guest for each of our episodes. They pick out their favourite F1 season and then we talk about it. Basically, it's a fairly straightforward idea. And I'm very pleased to welcome today Maurice Hamilton, covering Formula One for, how long, Maurice?
Longer than I care to remember, Kevin, but first one was South Africa 77, so you do the sums.
Okay. Well, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be that rude. But what I said that for was to show that you had quite a few seasons with personal experience that you could choose from. So let's get into it then. So what season have you gone for and why?
I chose 2007 simply because, Kevin, I've never known a season like it. It had absolutely everything, not just the arrival of Lewis Hamilton on the scene, but also Spygate, which is a phenomenon which I would never like to see again. We certainly hadn't seen before. And it almost took Formula One apart. And being a national newspaper reporter, I had to cover all of this. And it stretched me and my colleagues like no other. We weren't just talking about Alonso v. Hamilton and the usual Formula One stuff. This was politics and nastiness. And it tore Formula One apart, actually, for quite some time. And we were in the thick of it all, doing all the races, all 17 races, trying to make sense of it all. And then we had that finale where the championship wasn't decided until the last race. So, I mean, what more could you wish for?
So it was both memorable on and off track, basically, wasn't it?
It was.
Lots going on to cover that year.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was just, we went into it knowing that, you know, Lewis Hamilton was arriving and it was going to be great. We had no idea he was going to be as good as he was. Neither did Fernando Alonso, I fancy. And that, of course, led to a lot of the problems. And then this Spygate erupted at the British Grand Prix right in the middle. And we were thinking, what on earth is going on? What is all this about? So we were just distracted by that as well. So, yeah, it was a case of not just talking about the track activity, as you say, but also in between, trying to fathom out who was doing what and to whom.
Well, let's try and get into it. But before we do, I'll just give the listeners some sort of basic information for context. So there were actually only four winners in 2007 because Ferrari and McLaren dominated the season. Kimi Raikkonen, who became world champion, won six times. Lewis Hamilton, Fernando Alonso on four wins apiece, and Felipe Massa in the other Ferrari with three. Although they would have had four other than the fact he handed over, of course, winning Brazil, didn't he, to help Kimi win the championship. Poles, Lewis Hamilton in his rookie season, six. Massa, six. Raikkonen, three. And Alonso, two. The McLaren was marginally the faster car and raw pace, but really it swung backwards and forwards between the two, didn't it? And we had that fantastic championship fight where Raikkonen came from being out of it, really, with two races to go, two wins on the trot, to beat both Hamilton and Alonso by 1 point. And Hamilton beat Alonso on second place countbacks, not even wins. So that's the context of the overall season. But I think, Maurice, we should probably start with, I would argue it didn't take anyone very long on McLaren or Fernando Alonso very long to realise what they had on their hands with Hamilton. I'd say the first corner at Melbourne, probably.
Exactly that. Exactly that. We thought that, you know, being a novice and Ron Dennis being Ron Dennis would have spoken to him and said, now look, Lewis, this is the first race, there's a long way to go. Watch that first corner at Melbourne because you'll always see somebody on the grass on the outside. We don't want it to be you because you'll be kicking yourself and it'll be a terrible start to your season. And I'm doing the commentary for BBC Radio 5 Live and I can't believe what I'm seeing. I'm saying, look at that. I mean, almost like a Murray Walker thing. Look at that, incredible. Because he was going around the outside and passing Fernando Alonso, and we're thinking, wow, this is going to be good. And that's the way it was.
And of course, that was the first of nine consecutive podiums in his first nine starts. Got to Canada, first pole, first win. Then he beats Fernando in a duel, really, at Indianapolis, where they're wheel-to-wheel down the main straight, and Alonso probably quicker on race pace, maybe, but couldn't get track position. And suddenly he's, you know, the rookie's leading the championship. So, but that obviously cranked up the tension within McLaren, didn't it? Because Alonso was, let's remember, a double world champion. He'd just moved from Renault. I know that there are people at McLaren who are very excited about him arriving. And some of them even made the point that because they had Alonso, that gave them the confidence to take a chance on a rookie. even a good one like Lewis Hamilton, I thought was very interesting. So Alonso is almost, he's almost penalised for being, oh, we know this guy's going to do the good job, we can take a risk with Hamilton. But the tension increased between them. Not so much between them, actually, the drivers themselves, but Alonso got frustrated within the team.
He did, because you're absolutely right in that there's no question that Fernando Alonso was on a roll when he arrived at McLaren. He'd won two world championships with Renault. He's gone to McLaren, who he thought were the better team, would supply him with the car to win the championship. And all things being equal, they would have done if things had panned out differently from the point of view of the fight with Lewis Hamilton. So he, I think, arrived not unreasonably expecting that they were going to look after him, that Lewis would learn the ropes as the season went on, and that he, Fernando, would be world champion for a third time, and that would be great. And I remember we went to, before the season started in Melbourne, there's a place called the Stoke House, which is on the St. Philip, the waterfront in St. Philip's Bay, Phillips, whatever it's called, the main waterfront there. And McLaren had a media get-together before the season started. And it's a lovely place to go. And they had the photo call for both drivers who arrived on a sort of surfboard thing, and they had their Vodafones, because Vodafone had just arrived as a new sponsor. So all of that, and it all looked hunky-dory. It looked really terrific, and Fernando was relaxed and calm and being nice about Lewis, and Lewis was paying tribute to this twice world champion he's been with, and everything looked great. And the thing was just turned on its head on Sunday afternoon. And from that moment on, you knew it wasn't going to be quite like Alan Fernando. Alonso certainly knew, hang on, this isn't actually in the script, but maybe as the season goes on, I'll be able to establish myself. And he wasn't.
No, well, Hamilton beat him for the first time in the race in Bahrain, which was only round three. Then, of course, there was the Spanish Grand Prix, yeah, Alonso's home race, and he goes off at the first corner. And then he does win at Monaco, but that's the first hint from Hamilton maybe not being as diplomatic as he could be, because he kind of suggested, didn't he, that, oh, I was told to be number two driver. So that didn't help the tension either.
No, not at all. I mean, he Lewis rolled this smoking bomb under the press room door where he said, well, it's got number two in my car, so I suppose that's what I am. Hint, meaning I could have and should have won this race in his view. McLaren had their tactical reasons for running it the way they did. But again, that was another call to Alonso thinking, hang on a minute, what's he talking about? Why doesn't he just behave himself and stay the dutiful number two? Lewis always maintained they were equal status within the team. And Ron Dennis, to be fair, always said it's every driver for himself. But he believed, of course, that Alonso would have the upper hand. And it wasn't working out that way at all. And Lewis firmly believed that they should have let him win at Monaco, and he wasn't happy about it, and he wasn't afraid to show it. That was the thing.
No, but Alonso wasn't happy either, was he? Because he was rattled by the comments, and he then went off three times at the first corner in Canada, once on the first lap and then two times afterwards, the race that that Hamilton won. So he must have felt it slipping away, but I suppose it really came to a head, at least publicly, on track in Hungary, Hungarian Grand Prix qualified. So talk us through how that played out, because obviously this is an era when they qualified on race fuel. So there was this, I mean, it seems absolutely ridiculous now. There were fuel burn laps. I mean, I just not sure the environmental credentials were quite there in 2007, were they? So they'd send them out to burn off the fuel, then come in and put some tyres on and go out and qualify on the low fuel that they now had. But of course, it didn't go to plan, did it, for McLaren in the Hungaro ring?
No, it was actually quite complicated. It was a difficult one to explain, particularly when you're on radio and then they're saying, so what happened? You think, oh my God, where do I start with this? Fernando had felt that Lewis had held him up because one was running with less fuel than the other, and it was the way it played out. And therefore, Fernando extracted his revenge, in quotes, when they made the final stop to, I think, were they just changing tyres? I can't remember if they were adding fuel or not. I don't think so.
I think it was just tyres.
Just tyres, that's right. And he held him up enough for Lewis not to be able to complete what would have been the fastest lap for him. And that's when it all kicked off big time, because then we had McLaren, unfortunately for them, had a briefing with the media after every qualifying session called Meet the Team. And of course, we were there, the media were there in droves to find out what on earth had been going on. And Ron Dennis was trying to sort it all out. And meanwhile, he'd been called to an FIA meeting, and it was left to Martin Whitmarsh to try and deal with the deputy. And it got out of hand. And things with the media, Alonso, Lewis didn't come initially to the to the briefing, and Alonso was there, and it was getting nasty, the questions, and Martin Whitmarsh had to come from the upper gallery upstairs down to try and wade in and stop all this, and the thing just got out of hand particularly. And then Ron Dennis arrived and said there'd been nothing wrong, and he was trying to cover it all up, but it was hopeless. He couldn't.
What I got a question for you really is, I don't understand why Alonso gets I don't understand why the stewards get involved. So Alonso had pole, was given a 5-place penalty, dropped him back, which effectively guaranteed Hamilton the victory, actually the opposite to what he was hoping to do, and McLaren weren't able to score points that weekend. I don't understand why the stewards got involved. Surely that's an internal, as far as I could see, there were no rules broken. I suppose you could say sport disrepute, but I mean, that's a vague term that you can use as and when you like, really. So why do you think the stewards got involved in that and just didn't leave McLaren to sort it out?
What you say, I think that there was confusion. It wasn't looking good. That this was not what the picture they wanted to have of these two guys messing around, it seemed. I can't remember the exact reason why they got involved, but I think was Lewis Hamilton's father involved somehow too? He'd gone to see the stewards, I believe. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and I think this one thing led to another, and then you just didn't know which way to turn. You didn't know who was saying what and to whom and what it all meant. It was very hard to follow.
So at the same time, McLaren's season is kind of falling apart behind the scenes as well, because by this point, Spygate has started to erupt, and actually Alonso plays his part in that after hungry, doesn't he? But perhaps before we get to that, if you'd just like to remind us all as to how the Spygate scandal unfolded.
We were at the British Grand Prix, and on the Thursday, it was a tradition to have press briefings with the drivers. And unfortunately for McLaren, they were also unveiling their new motorhome. It's not a motorhome, but they had a brand new one there. And that was ostensibly why we were all called in to see this wonderful new place that they had. And the store, Ferrari issued a press release saying that somebody was under investigation for receiving information from McLaren. And the whole thing kicked off. We didn't understand what was this about. We had no information other than this one release. And Ron Dennis was trying to find out himself, because you had the impression he did not know what was going on within his own team. And for a man who is very, very strict about how things operate in his team, you know, for example, before the season started, he called the British media in for a lunch. And at that lunch, he was explaining precisely how we were going to deal with Lewis Hamilton and how McLaren were going to let him speak to us. It was all going to be under tight control. We're going to have a very good, clean operation, he said. And then this is suddenly blowing up in his face, because the media then are saying, what's going on within your team, Ron? And he actually didn't know the answer, because all we knew was that McLaren had somehow, an employee at McLaren had got the hold of 730-odd pages, I think, was it, of a Ferrari manual, deeply sensitive stuff, had landed up within McLaren, or at least in the hands of a McLaren employee, and Ron didn't know anything about it.
And it kicked off for months and months and months, didn't it? And I think they actually were originally exonerated, but then there was, I think after Hungary, Alonso said that he was going to give things away, so he didn't get number one status, and Ron actually went straight to FIA and said that this has happened, because you do get the impression throughout that Dennis hadn't been involved in any of it at any point, and he was trying to deal with the situation. And of course they ended up with $100 million fine and no championship points. Had there been championship points, had they been able to count the both drivers' points tallies, they would have been constructors' championship. So it was very damaging to McLaren over a long period of time afterwards, really, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, not just the financial $100 million fine, which is incredible, even by today's standards, never mind back.
Even though they were proved that the IP, there was no any proof that the IP had been used, merely that it had been possessed.
That's right, that it was in their possession. And also to lose their points, it also meant that in 2008, because you know the hierarchy in the pit lane is such that the top teams are at the smart end, and the bottom teams have got smaller garages at the other end, and that's where McLaren ended up in 2008, which is pretty hard for Ron to take.
I know there are people that are at McLaren at the time who said that they feel that actually their subsequent decline, which didn't kick in consistently for a little while, partly was due to the fact that they couldn't invest in new facilities and new resources as Red Bull became stronger, and obviously then Mercedes came in, and it's taken them quite a while to get back to that position now. So it was quite it was an unprecedented fine, wasn't it, for a, well, any sporting team, never mind motor racing.
Well, it was. I mean, the whole thing was unprecedented. The whole business of the issuing of the documents to McLaren, the whole way it was done. I mean, it was spying. We all know in Formula One that you have a little furtive look at your opposition, and you, on the grid they all have a little look, and you have got photographers taking pictures of the cars on track. We all know about that.
He's always wandering around everyone else's cars, isn't he?
Yeah.
And probably going, that's wrong.
And they all, I mean, I remember standing with a photographer at in practice, and he was taking pictures and pushing a little button on his belt, and apparently this picture was going directly into, I won't mention the team's name, into their motorhome, where it was being sent back to the factory for analysis. And they'd asked for a particular picture to be taken of the car at a certain angle. That we knew was going on. But this was just something entirely different. And Ron clearly didn't know anything about it. And for a man who prided himself on being in complete command and having everything squeaky clean, it was a heck of a shock.
Mm. And that finished off the constructors' battle, such as it was. But obviously the drivers' fight continued. I mean, I think probably it tended to go with whichever car suited that track at that moment, didn't it? So there weren't that many. It was almost the teammates fighting each other, and then it would swap round race by race. But there were a couple of exceptions. I mean, I think probably... I always thought Alonso's win at the Nürburgring, for example, when it rained towards the end and he overtook Massa, was a driver making the difference at a key moment.
It was a brilliant move, that round that S, that left right, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Massa got upset about it, but it was completely reasonable.
it was a Max Verstappen move. It was just brilliant.
And then of course Hamilton's win in the wet in Fuji was fantastic on a day that Alonso crashed. So you're sort of setting up this situation where the McLarens have taken points off each other. It's one of those classic stories. And Raikkonen, who'd struggled a little bit as his first year at Ferrari, he'd won the first race, but he struggled a little bit to get his head around the car and the Bridgestones. So obviously, he'd been racing on Michelin. This was the first year of Bridgestone supplying the whole team, all the teams, the whole grid. But in the second half of the season, he really came on strong. So while all these political things happening at McLaren, probably the least political driver on the grid, just racked up points and points and points. And then, of course, we came to China, and that's probably the moment where Hamilton most looked like a rookie. Is that fair? Do you think that's fair?
Look, at one point, I think I'm right in saying that Kimi was 17 points behind coming up towards the end of the season, and he recovered to win it by one. And yes, China was... Well, you mentioned Fuji. That was a costly mistake by Fernando when he spun off. That really did cost him points, but also, I think, a little bit of pride as well. And Lewis was having a great race in the wet. And it led to China with... there's more repercussions there. I can't remember exactly what the politics were, but I remember... We were all on tenterhooks trying to find out what on earth was going on with the latest development within the politics. And Fernando smashed down the office, put his fist through the office door at McLaren because he wasn't very happy with the way things had gone. He thought he wasn't getting a good deal. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I think that if they hadn't had any of this nonsense, and if Fernando had really got down to it, he should have won the championship easily. I don't know whether you think that's an argument or not, but I think he got so consumed by what was going on. I remember Tyler Alexander, who was one of the stalwarts of the McLaren team. He passed on since, but a lovely guy, and he'd been around with Bruce right from day one. And he was saying to me at one stage towards the end of the season, he said, look, he said, I know you guys are led to believe that we at McLaren are all for Lewis Hamilton because of Ron wants to protect him and look after him. But there's a number of us who are a little bit fed up with the way this is playing out. And we would like Fernando to win because we think he's bloody good. And Tyler had actually gone and taken the trouble of trying to talk to Fernando in private and saying, look, we're with you, because Fernando had this thought that the whole team were against him, and Tyler said, no, we're not. So just get your head around it. But unfortunately, according to Tyler, Fernando was having guys breathing in his ear, his management telling him all sorts of stuff, and he was believing them. And instead of focusing on the job of going out and winning races and getting points, he was allowing his mind to get clouded by what was going on. So it was a very mixed picture, and he should have won that championship.
I just feel that with the two drivers there, I mean, actually, Alonso, and we spoke to him 10 years later as for a kind of anniversary piece, and he did say that it wasn't Hamilton that was a problem, it was the situation with the team. And he basically said, well, we had two champion drivers and we managed not to win the championship, so something must have been managed incorrectly, which I think is fair. Quite yes. Who did the mismanaging and when, I suppose, is the debate. But I mean, either one of them could. I mean, when he was on his good days, Alonso, in that season, he was, even Hamilton couldn't hang on to him. Monza, for example, he was just gone.
He's world class. I mean, arguably still is. I mean, when the conditions are right, I mean, he is just brilliant, and he should have won that championship. All things, for the reasons we've said earlier, because Lewis was still learning and would have accepted it. Fernando was diverted, shall we say.
Well, let's just look at those points you mentioned. So after Japan, when Alonso had crashed and Hamilton won brilliantly, one of his early wet weather wins, which he racked up very many, he had 107 points. This is the old days of 10 points for a win, 8 for second, etc. Alonso was 12 points behind in 95, and Raikkonen was on 90, as you say, 17 points behind with 20 points available. Go to China, one of those damp, drying races. Hamilton doing a good job when it was slippery, but it just stayed. You could even see on the TV that the white, we'd call it canvas, it's probably something else now, is it, with modern size, was beginning to come through. And he should have come in, shouldn't he? He should have come in early and got on to dry tyres. And when he finally did come in, he stuffed it onto the gravel in the pit entry.
Yeah, I think the team, to be fair to Lewis, kept him out longer. I think he wanted to come in, and they kept probably from the point of view of tire wear, with the tires they're about to put on, they want to keep that final pit, that final stint, as short as possible. I can't remember the exact details, but he was definitely kept out a lap longer, and you could see the wear, as you say. But to actually go off at 20 miles an hour into the gravel, you thought, is there anything else in this season that was unbelievable?
I think we'd probably agree it's the greatest rookie season in F1 history. Must be, mustn't it? I would say. But that moment, you think an Alain Prost, a Mark Schumacher, and Ayrton Senna goes, I'm coming in, chaps. But then they make the call themselves. But maybe, I don't know, it was inexperience. He just seemed unwilling to do that. Because he must have known he had no grip at that point.
Exactly. He would have felt it. But I think you're right. I think there'd been so much going on. And all the, we talk, going back to Monaco, where he was probably spoken to quite sharply by the McLaren management over saying what he did to the media. And he was probably told to behave himself. And he, again, in his first season, he probably thought, well, I'm not quite sure what's going on here. I know the car feels squirrely. There's something wrong. I want to come in and change tires. They know more than me. So he's probably relying on the team, listening to their instructions, something like that.
And, of course, Raikkonen then won the race. Alonso was second. So we go into the Interlagos finale with Hamilton only 4 points ahead of Alonso, and Raikkonen still 7 behind. He's still the one up against it. You think McLaren surely have got to close it out with one of the drivers. But of course, Hamilton makes a mistake early on. He then has a strange transmission glitch for literally 25 seconds, and then it clears itself. I think it was transmission. Massa at his home ground moves out of the way. Raikkonen wins. Alonso's third, and Raikkonen wins the championship by a point. Just absolutely unbelievable.
You can imagine the conspiracy theories, can't you, when Lewis had that problem and then it came back?
Oh, they were, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, God, can you imagine now with social media? It's, oh.
But the thing is, about 2007, it didn't seem strange. It just seemed, oh, that's something else. Because it was just every race there was something going on. And that was it. You thought, oh, and then suddenly he gets it back again. And then Kimi goes and wins the championship.
And you got the impression, oh, well, you would know best than me, but from afar, it looked like Alonso didn't look totally upset that it was Raikkonen won the championship and not Hamilton.
It didn't appear to be, no. And I remember after the race, Kimi, you know what, he's just how laid back he is. And he won the championship. There was all the hoo-ha and stuff in the media centre. And instead of hanging around and celebrating with the team and doing loads of interviews, I remember seeing him with his backpack on and his friend going out down the back of the paddock to the car park, because you could look down from the paddock and see the car park. And there was Kimi and his mate leaving and driving out, leaving behind the team, still celebrating up behind in the garages. And he was off just to do his own thing in a nightclub.
Yeah. Well, that's quite Kimi, isn't it? I think there was something like, I mean, I think you're right. I think a McLaren driver, probably Alonso, should have been world champion that year. But there did seem something sort of appropriate that Raikkonen would be the, as I say, about the least political operator, would barely say anything to the team, never mind try and do things behind the scenes, that just got on with it and came out on top. And of course, beat the team that he'd been near to winning the championship with, but never quite managed it. But I wanted to put the top 10 drivers to you. We look at the Auto Course and Autosport top 10s. I'll do the top fives, actually. But I mean, really, it's a leading four, isn't it? Those four quite well ahead, I think, that particular season. Now, normally, I like to point out the differences between the two lists. But the top five are exactly the same. So both Nigel Roebuck and Alan Henry both had Hamilton first, Raikkonen second, Alonso third, Massa fourth, Nick Heidfeld, who we'll come to in a moment, in fifth for both of them. An impressive season I think everyone forgets about, actually. So do you agree with that? Would you still, looking back? So I think obviously Hamilton got bonus points in their eyes, I'm sure, for being a rookie, because it was such a remarkable performance. But would you change those lists, or do you think that that's a fair order, Hamilton, Raikkonen and Alonso?
I think Kevin Hengat's about right. I think Lewis, whatever you may say about the ins and outs of 2007 and the politics and Spygate and all the rest of it, that debut season for Lewis Hamilton was phenomenal. Starting at the first corner of the first race, just quite mind-blowing, brilliant. Great to be able, as a reporter for a British newspaper, to write about. It was just super. So yeah, I'm a little bit biased, obviously, because from that point of view. But from a newspaper man's point of view, it was a fantastic season because there was always something going on. And Lewis Hamilton was at the forefront of it all, one way or the other. And so, yeah, I would... But forgetting that, from the point of view of auto sport and auto course, and the top 10s, yes, I would have had him number one, I think.
Yeah, that seems fair enough. I think he made fewer mistakes than Alonso. And Alonso's famous for, you know, his relentlessness. And yeah. I mean, 5 years later, 2012, I mean, he barely gave away a point in that Ferrari, did he? So it's pretty amazing that Hamilton sort of forced that. But I think you're probably right. If Alonso sort of kept to his game and almost been less paranoid, if that's the right word, he probably still would have delivered it. I mean, we should talk a little bit about Ferrari. I mean, they got into trouble at the very first race with the new floor, which they got told to take off, but you can keep the points, which obviously, given what happened at the end of the season, was also an interesting point. But it was their first post-Mark Schumacher, Ross Brawn season after all those years of domination and championship. So was there a feeling before the season that Ferrari was still going to be up there, or were there some doubts around?
No, there was doubts. We weren't really sure. And it's interesting you talk about that floor. It was a sprung floor, wasn't it? And it was... Am I right in saying I think it was McLaren pointed it out?
McLaren protested it. Yes. So set the tone for the season.
Exactly. So then we get the story about they've got all this information. Oh, really? Have they? Oh, I wonder how they knew about the sprung floor. You know, just one thing led to another. But yeah, we didn't really know. Like, going into any season, we weren't really sure how they were going to fare.
No, but let's look at the... I thought we should look a bit further down the grid. It wasn't just about the top two. Yeah. I mean, the reason that you've picked 2007 is clearly McLaren, Ferrari and Hamilton, Alonso, which I think is fair enough. It's going to be the thing that most people remember. But let's, if you can remember, I think we should talk about Nick Heidfeld a little bit, because he was fifth in the championship. He beat Robert Kubica, who everyone now would say was a better driver. Kubica was at that enormous crash in Montreal, absolutely huge. Probably one of the worst F1 crashes of the 21st century, I would say. But Heidfeld was just consistently the next guy, wasn't he, after those top four? Really, probably his best season in F1, actually.
Probably. I need to see the figures, Kevin. But yeah, I think it probably was. And I mean, he'd had a great... Back coming through, the backstory of him arriving in Formula 1 was good. He'd done all the right things. It was one of those guys that's eventually ended up not in the right place at the right time, but was certainly very capable and did some great results. Just being consistent, being consistently quick.
And we should also point out that it was the arrival of another future world champion that season, not for the whole year. So we've obviously got Lewis Hamilton, who went on to win 7 world championships, but a four-time world champion also joined during the season, which was Sebastian Vettel, with 1 race for BMW Sauber before he joined Toro Rosso. So what do you remember about his arrival? And he scored points on his debut in 8th place at the USGP. So what do you remember about Seb's arrival?
That had to be impressive, scoring points. He he just made such a clean job of it. I remember talking to Gerhard Berger about him, actually saying, do you know him? And he said, yeah. He said, we think he's very, very good. And of course, what was then? It was Toro Rosso, wasn't it then?
It was, yeah.
They couldn't believe their luck when BMW let him go, because they just thought he is the guy. They were very impressed, as were we, because everything about him, he was mature, and of course it proved to be correct.
Yeah, he had that faux pas, didn't he, behind the safety car in Japan, where
he booted
Mark Webber in the Red Bull while they were behind the safety car.
He was in tears after that,
which was very unfortunate. Fairly typical Mark Webber luck as well at the time.
It was.
Because his car wasn't particularly reliable that year either.
And another 2007 story, you know, the way that panned out, you know, the way what else is going to happen?
Yes, yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I think, there's so many different storylines that we could look. I mean, actually, one thing that I noticed that I'd forgotten is the last year traction control before they banned it with the standard ECU for 2008. So, yeah, I'd forgotten that. I thought that was quite an interesting little aside as well. But I can't let 2007 slide without talking about one of the worst F1 cars, certainly pound for pound, in the 75 years of the championship, and that is the Honda, the Honda RA107, the Earth car that I'm sure people will remember. Bearing in mind the drivers they had, Jenson Button, who'd obviously win the world championship just a couple of years later, and Rubens Barrichello, who'd already won quite a few races for Ferrari. Button scored 6 points, and Barrichello didn't score any. Really, a pretty terrible performance from a manufacturer, not just any manufacturer, one with good history in the sport.
Not only that, but it looked awful, didn't it?
It wasn't a good car, was it in any way?
Everything about the whole concept, the way the team were going on about this Earth thing, the way the transporter was all done out and the car looked terrible. I think character building is the word you have to use for poor old Rubens and Jensen. And even it got worse in 08 when, of course, the car caught fire at the end of the season in Interlagos.
Yeah, they did have a couple of years. That sort of laid the foundations for the Braun team, which then became Mercedes. And that's a whole other storyline that we could go into. We won't. But before we sort of finish off, I just want to cover off a couple of things. So with McLaren thrown out of the Constructors' Championship, and BMW Sauber was second by miles behind Ferrari, but miles ahead of Renault, which of course just off the back of winning two world championships with Fernando Alonso. But they really struggled with the tyre change, didn't they, from Michelin to Bridgestone. And I suppose you'd say maybe the drivers weren't quite at the Alonso level, were they?
No, and the Michelin tyres had been built around them, and there was no question about that. That they were that was a perfect combination, and yeah, it was never really going to come right after that.
I should say that Heikki Hovelainen did do well enough to get a McLaren contract for the year, so it wasn't that terrible. I don't think the blame was laid at his door. And Williams, Nico Rosberg showing some flashes of
fastest lap.
What we'd see. First race in 2006, he got fastest lap, but then I think he single handedly scored, got Williams into fourth in the Constructors' Championship. So I think he was on people's lists as well. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention, remember, recall?
Yeah, I've got one little story. People forget that when you've got a season like that, where you've got Spygate and you've got this tension growing in the paddock, and it becomes a national thing. So we've got McLaren and Ferrari, Britain and Italy, and it spreads actually to the point where even amongst the media, you know, there's suspicion, and the Italian journalists are saying, "What do you guys know?" And we're saying, "Well, what do you guys know?" And we got to China, and things have got pretty fraught, very, very tense. And McLaren had a very good habit of, after qualifying on the Saturday, they would have a media briefing with their drivers, and they would split it in two. There would be the international media, and then Lewis would stay on for the British media, and we would get some special little nuggets for ourselves for our Sunday papers and so on. So we're in China, and we've heard rumours about Fernando being very hacked off and beaten down doors, and Lewis is sort of being sort of in the middle of it all, being, well, I don't know what's going on. I'm just driving
the car.
I'm just driving, doing my best. So the international media have all been ushered out of the room. They're sitting, there's about five or six of us from the British media. And suddenly, towards the end, the door opens and an Italian journalist comes in. And he says, "Scoozy, Scoozy, Scoozy." And he reaches over, and sitting on the table is his tape recorder. And it's running. So this, of course, is a no-no, because we're getting what we expect to be fairly exclusive stuff for the British press. And he's got this tape recorder running, and he, feigning all innocence, the guy from the News of the World gets up and almost floors him, and a whole riot breaks out. And Lewis, who has got no idea what any of this is about, he's just doing his bit driving the car, is sitting there, and all hell is breaking out around him, and his jaw drops open, and we're saying to him, this is what's going on, it's spreading throughout the whole paddock, this tension, and summed it up beautifully.
If it's just to add up to your point, there's still people fighting that battle. Now, I wrote a piece a year or two ago picking out the best cars never to win the World Championship, and I included the 2007 McLaren and said, oh, it would have won the Constructors' Championship had they not been thrown out. And I got an ex-Ferrari employee writing to say, actually, because they lost the points in Hungary, we'd have still won it. And so I had to slightly reword to say, if they'd scored all the points and their driver scored, they would have won. So still those little battles being fought over a decade and a half.
It affects everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Maurice. That was great to look back at 2007. Is the 2007 season your best season? Have you got another one that you'd like to throw into the mix for us to talk about? Let us know at autosport@autosport.com. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast.